You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ira Glass is the creator and host of This American Life, one of public radio's most popular shows, and the TV version of the show just completed its first season on Showtime. But he's here for something very different, related, perhaps. He's edited a new collection of essays called The New Kings of Nonfiction. It is published by Riverhead Books. And as always, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Ira Glass to the show. Hi, Ira.
Hi. As always, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is not a typical essay collection. It's really more pieces by nonfiction storytellers. Sort of the kind of thing you do on your show.
I guess so. I realized actually at some point midway into collecting the stories how the aesthetics of the stories was very similar to the aesthetics of the radio show This American Life, that these reporters are just like, in addition to being fantastic reporters and documenting things that other people aren't documenting and just thinking through ideas in an original way, in addition to all that, they're all just amazing entertainers. They really have the will to try to write something compelling and entertaining.
Well, you use one of your own experiences to describe how some of this works. In the introduction, you tell the story about how you covered for a daily news show on public radio a story that turned into a fable. Can you tell us that?
Well, this is this story years ago there was a guy named Jack Davis who was this guy from the white suburbs of Chicago, a very proud Republican, very proud Rush Limbaugh fan, and he was going to a restaurant in downtown Chicago, and the way that Chicago is set up, Cabrini Green, the public housing project, is right next to one of the most expensive. It was Cabrini Green's all being ripped down now, but back in the day, it was right next to one of the richest neighborhoods in the city. He was at a fancy restaurant, and he just got to thinking that kids in Cabrini could learn about the free market and learn capitalism if they would get into a business. And he thought, what business could I get them in? And he got the idea that there was all this land in Cabrini that nobody was using for anything. They could grow vegetables, sell it to these high end restaurants that are in the rich neighborhood, like across the street, and they could make a lot of money that way and learn market capitalism. And he had been a gardener, and so he undertook this project, and so he's down there trying to like get the kids to work, and it didn't go very well. Basically, he did not understand the culture of the projects. He knew no black people in his daily life up until he did this. And at some point, he enlisted this other guy who was like this beloved dad from the projects. This guy named Dan Underwood, who just had been there for years. He grew up there. He ran a double Dutch jump rope team for Cabrini kids that was the number one double Dutch jump rope team in the city. He ran a drum and color guard squad. He ran martial arts classes. Like, everybody loved Dan. And basically, Jack, got grant money to make this project of his work and was able to pay Dan money. And so Dan and Dan's kids were working in the garden. So Dan comes in, and they would get into these fights that seemed to me to be like the perfect I feel like they were summarizing all of American social policy regarding the welfare issue, like on a daily basis in the middle of the vegetable garden, where a kid wouldn't show up to do his work shift in the garden. And Dan would, he'd go and talk to the parents, and he'd see what was going on in the kid's life, and he'd just check in on the kid. And Jack was all about like, well, if he doesn't come, you got to cut him off. You can't pay him. You got to teach him a lesson. And Dan was like, just be softer, be softer. And Jack was all about like, we got to get tough. They've got to learn. They can't coddle these kids anymore. It's for their own good. We're gonna make them self sufficient. We got to teach them to be self sufficient. And, the guy from the projects was all just like, you don't really know what you're talking about. A little coddling might not be such a bad thing, and it's hard to get people to do something they've never done.
But Ira, this could have just been an interesting news story. You made it into something else.
Well, it seemed to me like what my office mate at the time at the NPR Bureau in Chicago, he was just like, are you – he was like, do you make these stories up? Like, where do you find these people? And he was very suspicious about the fable-like qualities of the story that it laid out so perfectly as such a perfect analog to the public policy debate. And I remember feeling at the time like, well, that's great when it always lays out as a fable. It's great when it starts to turn into a fable. Like, that's what you want. And to discard that is to ignore tools that make stories powerful. And we had a kind of an ongoing debate about this in the NPR Chicago Bureau, where one of our colleagues was a Columbia University journalism school grad, and she, like, her report, she was incredibly funny, smart, like, it's like a wonderful, wonderful person. And she would come back from her stories with all these funny things that happened out in the story that people had said to her, and this and that, little things she was observed. None of them ever made it into her stories, you know, on All Things Considered, Morning Edition. None of them. Her stories were just like dry as bones. And all of those things
probably would have made it into the stories if you had been doing the reporting.
Yes, exactly.
So it turns out to be a different story. Because you were covering it, somebody else would have come back with something quite different, even though it may have been pretty much the same ultimate message. But is there a distortion? Who's doing the distorting there then?
Well, I wouldn't even use the word distortion, because that implies like some lie is being put forward. I mean, in my
version of
the
story. But it gets skewed one way or another, Ira. And if it gets skewed one way, the same story. Sometimes I watch coverage on NBC and CBS, and I get the same story, but I get two different stories.
Sure, sure. I mean, I feel like this is more like in that other reporter's story, you wouldn't get the characters and the scenes. You wouldn't get as much of a feeling for the people. It would be less complete. It would be less a complete version of the world, although every fact in it would be true. So, I mean, you know, I argue kind of on principle for my kind of story. But truthfully, to say it's better I feel like it's not better. It's just a question of taste. This is my taste. I prefer stories with people in them, you know, and with feeling in them. And, you know, like, I think that makes it more complete.
Well, to some degree, they draw upon the skills that writers of fiction employ.
Yes.
You have expressed some disdain for the term literary nonfiction, but it is fairly descriptive of what you've included in this book, isn't it?
Yeah. I hate the term, though, because the term makes it sound like such a bore. It really is like daring somebody to read something, to call it literary nonfiction. It's like you know what it's like, Lenny? You know what it's like? It's like the word documentary. I feel like as soon as you say the word documentary, it's like saying, don't listen to my program.
Well, then what do documentary filmmakers do?
I don't know. They should come up with another term. I mean, I do a documentary radio show, but we never actually use the word documentary on the air because I think it's a turnoff.
Yeah, well, in this case, what we're talking about is stories that have strong narrative voices.
Yes.
Writers like Malcolm Gladwell and Susan Orlean have voices as distinctive, so distinctive that they actually become a large part of the story. Didn't writers once feel that they should try to keep themselves out of the story when they were reporting on something? Is this the new journalism, the change? Have the rules changed because of the new journalism?
I mean, I think a lot changed because of the new journalism. I mean, I think that people understood a kind of freedom that would make the stories more powerful and also make the narrator more of a character. I mean, I don't think it's – I think Malcolm Gladwell and Susan Orlean, you know, both of them New Yorker writers, like, I think that they're present in their stories. But I think that still the people who they're documenting – are even more present. I think in the case of Malcolm and Susan, they're simply not pretending. They've given up the pretense of invisibility. Do you know what I mean? Like, you feel their presence as very fair and very interesting companions in looking at these other people, which is really how – I mean, I think of that with the radio show often that, you know, we're doing stories – when I'm doing a story about teenagers in Jersey – I mean, part of what I'm putting on the air is my reaction to those teenagers, but the goal of it, the whole thing, is to document those teenagers.
Yeah, Ira Glass is my guest. He has edited and written the introduction to a new book called "New Kings of Nonfiction," published by Riverhead. It also includes profiles and interviews. How did Chuck Klosterman get Val Kilmer to speak to him so unguardedly?
I have no idea.
It is wild.
Chuck Klosterman is a real wonder. Yeah, yeah. He goes out to this ranch, and Val Kilmer just just kind of puts it out there. And Kosterman, I wanted to get in the book because he's just such a smart observer of people and so insanely funny. And truthfully, it was really hard to choose between this story and two or three others of his. I think you know, I don't know. I couldn't tell in reading it if Kosterman just caught him on a good day or if Kosterman was doing something to egg him into it.
Well, when Val Kilmer saw the story, which was called Call Me Lizard King, Really I Insist, he must have gone bonkers just reading the title. Maybe he felt a little better after he read the piece, but certainly his handlers had to have been gnashing their teeth.
Perhaps. I mean, one of the things that Kosterman says is that Kilmer trusted him because Kosterman had written a thing praising Kilmer in the past. And so he felt like, well, I could say anything to this guy because he likes me.
He's a friend. He's a fan. He will not include anything that'll make me look bad. Yeah. Big mistake. Well, of course, you ran into that a little bit when you talked to Deborah Solomon of the New York Times Magazine. Did you feel what she did was against the rules?
I mean, I would just as soon like lay this to rest because I feel like more has been said about it than seems worth it. I mean, I believe that she wrote a question after our interview and inserted it into the question and answer format of her column. She insists apparently that she didn't do that, and there's no tape or anything. And I feel like now we're in a kind of weird he said, she said. I don't feel like she's a bad reporter. I mean, she seems, in fact, like an incredibly perceptive reporter.
Although she got her wrist slapped in the public editor's response to a number of complaints in the Times. Okay, I mean, I see no reason to stick with this. This has nothing to do with the book, but perhaps it has to do
case.
Go ahead.
You know, in that case, I feel like the way that she wrote the question and the way that she, I feel like, excerpted a sentence out of context of something I said to her in the interview, in the answer, I feel like it didn't change the facts of anything. The thing I said to her, I did say it to a reporter. You know what I mean? You take your chances, and I'm good with that. You know, I don't feel like, and truthfully, like, it made me look like a little bit of an ass.
Which is usually her point.
I guess, but I feel like in the end, like that it's a question of tone, and I mean, really, like it's this, you know, in terms of like something that could go wrong in a newspaper, I feel like it's the smallest thing. Like so somebody who has a TV show to promote looks a little bit like an ass. You know, it really, it's small. I mean, what was large was that I thought she added a question later that like it seemed clear to me that she had.
Is it okay to present yourself, however is expedient to get the story, as a sympathizer to the subject, a fellow sports fan, or to pretend to have certain political beliefs like Dan Savage did when he pretended that he was a Republican?
I mean, in the case of Dan Savage, I mean, Dan Savage is pretty clear with those people that he doesn't agree with them, you know, so I feel like that's fair. He didn't, you know, to talk to your larger question, is it fair to pretend to be something you're not? I mean, it's not the way that I would behave. And, you know, I feel like it's best to represent who you really are. And if you've got a disagreement with somebody in a story, you tell them, partly because that's going to generate the most interesting quote. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you're out there getting a story, you know, you want them to say interesting stuff. And one of the quickest ways is if you let them know, you know, I think you're wrong about this. And then they'll fight for their side. And so, you know, generally when people do stuff on our show, we pretty much insist that they don't come back later in writing a story and say something on the air that they haven't said to the subject, that we make them say it to the subject, you know, out of fairness to the person. I don't think it's fair otherwise.
Well, in the case of Dan Savage, the piece is called My Republican Journey. He went undercover, but
that's a fantastic story, actually. I included that just because it's so incredible that he did it. This was back when Pat Buchanan was doing very well in the Republican primaries a couple of election cycles ago and in his race for the president. And Dan just felt like, well, you know, his mom always taught him, fighting a group from the outside isn't as powerful as, like, you know, going inside. You know, basically, if you want to change the system, work within the system. And so he joined the Republican Party. And Dan is a, you know, liberal. He's a, I don't even know what the word is.
A gay rights activist.
Yeah, they say that makes it sound like he's you know, marching and organizing. I mean, mostly he's writing about stuff. But yeah, gay rights activist. And so he joins the Republican Party, and he very much in all of their meetings because in his district, because he was in a gay neighborhood, there are no other gays, and so he becomes like a state assemblyman to their convention, and so he then gets like swept up in the national in their statewide convention in Washington State. And basically at every step along the way, he introduces resolutions saying, we, the Republican Party of Washington State, will not use gay bashing as a tactic to divide voters. We stand for equal rights for all people, including gays and straights, and then forces them to debate it and vote on it. And so I feel like in that case, you know, the people who he was talking to knew what they were getting. And truthfully, it's just an amazing piece of reporting.
Although it might have helped if he had actually registered as a Republican at some point. It gives me a little more sympathy for O.J. Simpson insisting that his interview with Katie Couric not be edited. And he also insisted that his lawyer be present if he wasn't photographed. Well, yeah. I guess they always tell me, be suspicious. And it's worked that way any number of times with me for interviews where I say, well, I didn't really say that, or I said that, but they left out the other half of the sentence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that happens all the time. I mean, you take a risk if you talk to a reporter, as everyone everywhere knows. I mean, generally, you know, I mean, my experience is people covering public radio, you know, tend not to be out to, I mean, basically, I feel like I can't complain. I've been treated pretty fairly.
Ira, we have to take a little break. We want to talk more in a little while. Stay with us.
Sure.
Ira Glass, host of This American Life, has edited and written the introduction to The New Kings of Nonfiction, a collection of, I guess we could say, personalized essays from Riverhead Books. We'll be back right after this. And we're back with Ira Glass, whose latest project is a collection of pieces called The New Kings of Nonfiction. He's edited and written the introduction, and the book features some of the best writers of nonfiction these days: Michael Lewis, Susan Orlean, Bill Buford, Jack Hitt, Chuck Klosterman, Malcolm Gladwell. What made you decide to edit a book, Ira? Don't you have enough outlets already for the stories that you find?
Point taken, yes. It's a fundraiser. There's a literacy group called 826 that was started by the writer Dave Eggers, and there's one here in New York, 826 NYC. It's over in Brooklyn behind a superhero supply shop where, if you haven't been, Leonard, you can buy—
I've been. It's incredible. You can buy all sorts of things that give you superpowers.
And including my favorite is that not only can, it's for the working superhero, where do you get your gear? And like, not only can you buy a cape, but they have the wind machine, so you can just check out how it looks in the mirror before you make your final purchase.
And they have invisibility kits and all sorts of interesting stuff.
Yeah, and then behind there is so basically the store functions as a kind of bait, as catnip for children. And then behind there's the literacy program where kids learn a lot of writing, and where kids can come and help them with their homework each day. So these are in a half dozen cities, and one was opening up in Chicago, and at the time I was still living in Chicago, and we needed to figure out a way to raise money to get the place started, and David Sedaris had done a collection to raise money for the New York chapter, and his collection is wonderful. It's called Children Playing Before a Statue of Hercules, where he chose his favorite pieces of short fiction. And basically, we just imitated that model, where I chose favorite pieces of nonfiction, stuff that I've loved and have shown to people over the years. And when it comes to Bill Buford's book, I've given away so many copies of that book. I don't even know how many it's been. And so we made the collection basically to raise money for 826.
Talking about Bill Buford, do you think the fans of the Manchester soccer team knew that he's a journalist when he accompanied them to Italy? These are people who'd been banned from away games by the team they supported.
Yeah, yeah, that's bad when the team itself bans you. He's quite clear with them, apparently. And like one of the things that I love about that piece of writing where he's going around with the soccer hooligans is he's utterly clear about the fact that they hate his guts and are totally suspicious for a very, very long time. And then occasionally one of them will deign to talk to him, and he'll get in with like – there are little moments where he'll get in with a group of them, and then he'll fall out of favor again. There's something about that story where I feel like it really captures the feeling of being a reporter where you're just like – you're wandering around trying to get somebody to talk to you, and often they're quite hostile, and then you say dumb things and you put them off. And like it's just that piece of writing is just – it's both he's taken on something that's so big and hard to know, which is about the pleasure of violence is in the end what he's writing about. But sort of scene by scene, it's so incredibly funny, and he himself is so like almost a comic figure in a lot of it.
Well, luckily he escapes the fate of the young Italian soccer fans who get knocked down, get their faces kicked in by his travel buddies.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah, no, I mean, what's remarkable about it as a piece of reporting, truthfully, is that by the end of it, I mean, he's trying to understand like why this group would want to riot every weekend. Basically, they've organized their lives so they can riot every weekend, and by the end of it, he's able to get across that there's a pleasure in violence, and not just like as an abstract idea. He tries to get across what it feels like moment by moment, and how he himself, as somebody who's there with them as they all go off, feels the same exhilaration and what it's about. And one of the things about his book Among the Thugs that he let us pull this from that's really beautiful is that over the course of the book he goes back to these ancient quotes, hundreds and thousands of years old, from ancient texts of other people who witnessed the same thing among crowds of their time. And so you get the feeling of what a primal thing this is in us, how it's there to be awakened in all of us, this feeling of pleasure of being in a rampaging mob.
Stephen King has edited the best short stories of 2007. He thinks the short story is in terrible trouble because so few readers in fact, magazines have been discontinuing their short stories except The New Yorker and some of the specialty magazines like Plowshares. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the nonfiction article is in healthier shape?
I do, yeah. There are many, many readers for it, and they're just incredible practitioners. I feel like everybody in this book just, you know, I see them do stuff in magazines and I just feel so inspired and jealous I feel like for long form nonfiction pieces, I mean, I know that it's a hard thing to break into for new writers and there are only certain places who do it, but the people who are doing it and the places where it's published, like The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, Harper's, there's just some amazing writing and really like people like Michael Lewis and these others. I feel like actually bringing a sensibility to it that seemed very much of this moment right now.
Do you think a fact checker spoke to Colin Duffy, Susan Orlin's subject in her article, The American Man Aged 10, to see if he did tell her that there were huge wildcats with rabies and gross stuff dripping from their teeth running rampant through his neighborhood?
I don't know. I believe that he probably told her, but I don't. She wrote that for Esquire, so I don't know if they have fact checkers. The scene you conjure is just as delicious as could be, though.
Yeah, well, I guess people. The thing is that you can report what people tell you, and then you can rely on your readers to be able to separate fact from fiction.
Yeah.
In this is something where the lines are often blurred. And I wonder what happens to some of the stories that are told on This American Life. Do you get letters from listeners who say, Ira, that could not have happened? I've lived in Cleveland for all these years and I've never seen anything like that.
No, we really don't. I mean, we're as careful as you can be.
You have fact checkers?
Well, our producers, I mean, we function as – we don't have a fact-checking department because we're such a small show. But we check out the stories as far as we can. I mean, we make the reporters go to other sources. Often, it since the stories are so personal, we'll end up going to people who you don't hear on the air and getting them to confirm facts. I mean, we confirm as much as can humanly be confirmed with pretty much everything that's on the air. And you know, we go to other people. We make them. We make the reporters go to other people. We make them show us that this is true. Now, where you get into a kind of difficult area is that some of the stories, you know, probably 15 or 20% of the stories involve people telling things that happened to them long ago, to which they and, you know, a member of their family who's now dead are the only witnesses. And there, you know, I mean, there, you know, you can only get so far in, you know, there you're either going to believe your writer or not. So there, you know, we go as far as we can go, and then we have to either trust the writer or we don't.
You never suspect David Sedaris of exaggerating just a bit for comic effect?
Well, David Sedaris, I mean, is straight up front about the fact that he's exaggerating. I feel like he doesn't pretend that he doesn't. But I feel like in the case of something like that, I feel like generally it's clear when he's exaggerating. I feel like you can tell. To me, you can tell. This reminds me of a debate that happened at the All Things Considered staff years ago. Before I did This American Life, before I was a reporter for NPR, I was one of the producers of All Things Considered, and one of my jobs was to produce the commentators. So I did that for years and produced Daniel Pinkwater and you know, all the various commentators. I was their guy. And after I left, a controversy erupted over a commentator named Bailey White, because she told a story in which, in the final moment of the story, a car is driven up onto I can't remember if it's a lawn or a porch of a house. And the next day at the staff meeting, at the morning meeting, Robert Siegel, the host of All Things Considered, asked the person who had taken over from me, a woman named Margaret Lowe Smith, he asked her, you know, that commentary that you put on the air of Bailey White, of the car up on the porch yesterday, was that true, in the strict sense of the word true? And Margaret said it had never even occurred to her to ask, because she assumed that it probably wasn't, that Bailey was writing in some sort of exaggerated way that would seem transparent to her. And the same thing, I remember all the commentators were questioned, are these commentaries true? And I remember one of their commentators at the time, Daniel Pinkwater, sent back an email saying, the events in my commentaries are more accurate than the events that they depict. And I feel like when you get into a comic writer, I feel like the tone of it is just, it's a different category of thing, and we edit it differently.
My guest is Ira Glass, and he has edited and written the introduction to a new collection called The New Kings of Nonfiction, published by Riverhead. You've just finished your first season with the television version of This American Life. You once said that radio was the most visual medium of all, so how did you work that out for yourself?
I mean, truthfully, I don't know what to say about that anymore. I mean, having pictures turns out to be enormously visual.
It does.
Yeah. It's a funny thing working with pictures. It's weird how literal everything has to be on television, whereas on the radio, it's so intimate and it's so easy for something to stand for something bigger. Whereas on TV, people become their literal selves.
Yeah, if you tell a story about the perfect child or the most beautiful house, every listener will envision it perfectly for themselves within their own ideas of what is perfect. But then when you put an image of either of them on television, people will see something very much more literal.
And the problem with that, actually, we get into a blink problem, which is, if you remember Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink, he talks about how we assess somebody in a second, you know, when we look at them. And I feel like something happens when people watch the TV stories that we have to be very careful of, that doesn't happen in the radio show, where people would just decide they like somebody or they don't based on their looks. And so we get emails, and I've seen in reviews, characters who we are portraying sympathetically, who every quote is trying to get across the fact that we're on their side. We're trying to tell their story. And people will react in ways to these characters that they never react to characters on the radio show. Like they don't even understand sometimes that we're being sympathetic.
They see the person as being scary or odd looking.
or they feel like we're trying to make fun of. It's happened with a bunch of the characters that people have written us saying, well, you're trying to make fun of that person. And we're like, we don't try to make fun of anybody on the show. You know, we're not trying to show them as being weird or quirky or anything. We simply are trying to sympathetically tell their story. But there's something about seeing, you know, the look on the rancher's face out in Texas when he's looking at his prized bull that somehow, like, people don't understand our intent sometimes. And I think it's just like a chemical thing that some people are going to be with you and have the same feelings about the look on somebody's face, and some people aren't.
So
in
did
a way
you
that
learn?
Just never happens on the radio.
So did you learn over the course of the season what you could do and what you couldn't do?
I mean, truthfully, like, it seems quite random. I mean, you know, we're always very careful to not make fun of the characters in the stories and not portray them as weirdos or you know, like, quirky characters. Like, that goes without saying. And so in the course of editing the show, sometimes this thing would happen where there was one story in one of the early episodes about old people in Burbank, California, who were putting on who were trying to make a movie. And sometimes in the original edit of it, somebody would say something, and then we would hold on the person for a beat. You know, there'd be a husband and wife, and he would say something, she would say something, he would say something, she would say something, and the camera would just hold on them for a beat. And there would be something in the holding on them for a beat that seemed to mock them. And so we would take it out. It would be just like we left the beat in for a second so you could just register what they said. But like when you would look at it, it would just be like, oh, we're making fun of them. And it would literally just be the pause after their words. And so that stuff we edited out before it ever made it to the air. Like, we weren't trying to make fun of anybody.
How do you like living in New York? You've moved back to New York from Chicago. You say that the food delivery here is really remarkable.
Now, I don't know if you've ever tried it, Leonard, but you can get food from anywhere.
But can't you get lunch delivered in Chicago?
I don't know. I never knew anybody to get a lunch delivered in Chicago in all my years there. I mean, sometimes you'd order in a pizza, but besides pizza, it wasn't in the daily customs of the city somehow, or at least in the circles I traveled in. No, the food delivery. I don't know. I mean, I really love it here. I mean, it's just a very interesting place, and you'd really have to be a very special kind of malcreant to not feel that.
On the other hand, there are nice things about Chicago, aren't there? What do you miss about Chicago?
I mean, I miss my friends. I miss the places I would go. You know, I mean, there were like they're people who I like and places I like. And Chicago is insanely lovely. It's right by the lake. It's incredibly clean. It's beautiful in a way that truthfully New York can't and won't ever try to compete with. And Chicago is Chicago you can drive, and I miss driving so much. It seems unnatural to listen to the radio if you're not in a car. Like I most Americans, like, I would do most of my radio listening in the car. And then you move to New York and radio listening means something else completely different. You know, we all listen to the radio, you know, somewhere else.
Well,
like,
usually
I was surprised that you could even have a radio station in New York without people in their cars all day.
And yet radio stations do very well in New York because we have a different kind of coverage. We often have coverage in every room of the house.
Yeah. It's so different.
And you're in Brooklyn? Our signal?
No, started off in Brooklyn and then moved to Chelsea.
Oh, well, our signal reaches Chelsea quite comfortably. So are you working on the next season now?
We are. We're shooting the next season, and so right now we're dividing our time as a staff between the radio show and the TV show. And we actually, one of the things about our first season that we weren't happy with is that we felt, in order to, it just turned out to be a crazy amount of work. And we knew it would be a lot, but it turned out to be even more than we thought. And we ended up doing a lot more reruns during the 8 months that we were shooting and editing. And this year, we're trying to actually not do that. We've hired more producers. We've changed the production schedule. And so we're now having the challenge of just turning out as many radio shows as we can.
And do the radio shows sometimes, is there some kind of a dialogue that you can develop between the two? Certain things that work on both, or certain things that you could do on radio that then inspire something a little different for television?
Sometimes stories will fall apart for one medium and then work for another. Like there's a story that we were considering for the radio show that actually somebody is out in Colorado scouting today. And that story is it takes place on this lot where they sell off cars that police have taken in raids and things like that. And just the scene on this particular lot is really something, because people buy these cars gambling that they'll be good enough to resell. And as a radio story, it seemed like it was a decent story, but then we found out that over half the population doesn't speak English. And then it seemed like actually the people – and then you get into that translation problem on the radio where people talk and you have to have a translator come in, and the people aren't as present on the radio with that kind of translation. And then we realized like, oh, this would be more powerful as a TV story because we can just see them talk and we'll subtitle it and they'll be a little more present emotionally. And so that's a case where like something would get kicked from the radio to the TV side. Usually what will happen is that it will get kicked from the TV to the radio side because we can't get the clearances to shoot, or because because almost no story is good for television. Well, I consider like almost everything seems it's so hard for us to find a story that we like enough that can be filmed that we end up, you know, just it's a lot harder to find the TV stories.
I have a suggestion for you, and that is use some of the stories from this book, because any number of them are quite terrific. The book is The New Kings of Nonfiction, with pieces by Mark Bowden, Bill Buford, Malcolm Gladwell, Jack Hitt, Chuck Klosterman, Michael Lewis, James McManus, Susan Orlean, Michael Pollan, Lee Sandlin, Dan Savage, Coco Henson-Scales, David Foster Wallace, and Lawrence Weschler. And my great thanks to you, Ira, for talking with us again.
Oh, my goodness. Thanks for having me.
And I'll be seeing you on television and listening on the radio. Or is it see you on the radio?
I was something like that. Yeah, I always forget to. Thanks.